You're listening to the Humans of DevOps podcast, a podcast focused on advancing the humans of DevOps through skills, knowledge, ideas, and learning, or the SKIL framework.
What the pandemic did was open up our homes to each other, right? You saw the human side in all of us. And to me, I think that's one of the silver linings of everything we've been through, because it shows there's so much more dimension to everybody than just what you do in your day job.
Hey everyone, it's Jason Baum, Director of Member Experience at DevOps Institute, and this is the Humans of DevOps podcast. Welcome back. I hope you had another great week. And if you didn't, that's okay. We're going to make it a great week this week. I like to do that little mantra with myself, my daughter, my wife. We all said, this is going to be the best week we've ever had. And each one, we really try. And I think we get close. And you know what? Now that we're a few weeks into spring now, for the Northern Hemisphere, that means things are starting to warm up and start to grow. And I feel like that's, especially coming out of winter, sometimes you have the winter blues. I think that's it's a nice time of year, certainly. I look forward to it. Weather getting nicer, people talking to each other more, socializing, you see them outside. And the COVID winter is retreating as well in many areas across the globe. And I think that's also allowing for us to interact again in ways that we really haven't had a chance to do, not just through the winter, but over the past couple of years. So fittingly, on today's episode, we're taking a look at the human side of development and a group of individuals whose job it is to interact and be social for a living, which is daunting to some. I think you could say that would be a little tiring for many. But I would assume for DevRels, it must be something that gets them going in the morning, excited and happy about for a living. Otherwise, I don't know how they do it. So we're going to get into that and more on today's podcast. And so DevRel, that's a term that's been tossed around. It's becoming more popular. We hear it frequently, but I don't know if many of us know the textbook definition. So I looked up a bunch and there's so many, but the one that I found that I really liked is that DevRel is essentially short for developer relations, and developer relations is pretty much exactly what that means, a marketing policy that prioritizes relationships with developers. In general society, there's this word known for PR, public relations, and you could essentially say that DevRel is the developer version of this, although that's incredibly simple. You know, DevRel is the marketing technique used to ensure that your company, products, and developers establish a good continuous relationship with the external developers through mutual communication. And that is very textbook. So we'll get into the non-textbook definition of that with my guest, Sarah Fatz. And Sarah is here today. Sarah leads the developer relations team at Progress. With more than 20 years in the software development space, she's built a community, partner, content, and influencer programs from the ground up. And when she's not working, she likes diving with sharks, running, and watching hockey. So she's really leading a boring life, you could say, diving with sharks. Who doesn't do that, right? So Sarah, welcome to the podcast. I really hope we could talk about sharks, by the way, towards the end of this podcast.
Thank you, Jason. Yeah, it's awesome to be here. And I will talk about sharks all day, every day, if you want to do that. So, oh, but awesome. I also love DevRel. So definitely
there's that too,
to
right?
That. Yes.
Yeah. Well, awesome. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast, Sarah. And are you ready to get human?
I am ready. Let's do it.
Let's do it. So let's just start out. So I kind of defined it, but you've got 20 years of experience in it. How have you seen DevRel? I didn't even know that developer relations was really well, you know what? I actually watched the movie Office Space the other day, and it's so funny because they tried to, I feel like, define the like, what is it that you do here? You know, line just sticks out. And so what is it about DevRel, and how have you seen it evolve, and how do you define it?
That's a great question. And it's funny because, you know, when I tell people what I do, when they ask me, oh, what do you do for a living? I'm like, oh, I lead a DevRel team. You either get the blank stare, or you get the, especially outside of our space, or you get, so is that like customer service? And so really, you know, DevRel has evolved a ton over the last 20 years. The way I like to look at it is that the people on my team, they're responsible for interacting and being active, engaged members of the community in a very genuine and authentic way, right? So not because they're forced to be there, but because they truly have a passion for software and technology, whether it's, you know, and I have people on my team who have different areas of subject matter expertise, and they all have niches within the community that they spend a lot of time. While they're in the community and part of the community, they're advocating for software developers as a whole. They're also bringing information back to our product teams to help influence the product so that they can help be the voice of the developer community and say, this is really what the community needs and wants, and vice versa. We can, you know, we do share what our products are about and what they do, but it's really not the only focus, right? There's a big chunk of what the team does, which is that is just about being, again, active, engaged members of the community, being thought leaders, helping educate people about software of all kinds, and not just particular front end frameworks, but things like accessibility and design for developers and topics like that that are you know, important in the development lifecycle in general.
So there's so much I want to talk about on today's podcast. It's so interesting, DevRel. And, you know, I feel like, you know, as you said, it's evolved so much. The first thing I kind of want to address is there's a stigma, there's a thought I feel like out there that developers, engineers, you name it, it's not social people. You know, that they're these introverts that are socially awkward and like to code and stare at their computers and never come up for air. And that's not true, right?
No, it's not true. I mean, and I think with anything, humans, they find their tribe, right? And so when you, even if you are, I actually just came out of a meeting where we were talking about, you know, people who are extroverts versus introverts and how does that work and how do we work together? Even if you are more introverted, there are still absolutely ways to be part of a community. And from a DevRel perspective, most of the people who find themselves in DevRel lean more towards extroversion, but it's really when you find a passion or an excitement for something, none of that really matters, right? Because what really matters is that we have this thing in common, and you can find that people come out of their holes and out of their, you know, when they have something that they're excited to talk about and share.
Yeah, you know, it's myself, I always say I'm a reluctant extrovert. But, you know, I can be very extrovert. I can be that, and I can turn it on and be incredibly social, but then I am usually exhausted afterwards. My daughter is like my daughter is very introverted, I would say, in a group setting. But you get her one-on-one or get her talking about a topic, and it's like, man, she could tell you literally everything about the movie Frozen. I mean, front and back, and like, I mean, will not stop talking when you bring up those topics. So I get what you're saying.
Yeah, it's funny. My husband's an engineer, and people will often say that he's very quiet until you get him talking about boating or fishing or aerospace or design or hockey. And our daughter is very much the same way. So she has leans a little more towards the extroverted side on some things, but she's definitely more like him with regard to that. So yeah.
So let's talk about you a little bit. You know, how did your personal life really like shape those work goals for you? You know, how did you get into the developer relations space? You talk about 20 years. With no social piece to it, I imagine that it looked different.
Yeah, the space has evolved a ton. And when I look back at my career, it makes sense now, but to tell you that that there was a deliberate path that took me to where I am right now would be a lie. Growing up as a kid, I was the middle child, and you know, my mom would talk about how my older brother was great at art and my younger brother was great at math and science. And she would pause when she would look at me and she'd say, "Sarah, you're really good with people." And I used to laugh. I used to think it was a total cop-out. And then I realized that she was not wrong in the sense that people are, it's where I get my energy, it's where I, where my passion is. And I've always had this huge passion for building community and being part of something bigger. And then in the, you know, fast forward to late 90s, when the internet boom was taking place, I fell in love with technology. I was working for a PR agency. And I remember coming home, and again, you know, remember, my husband's an aerospace engineer. I come home from work one day, and I am talking a mile a minute. I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, we learned today that with the Quest was putting in an all optical network, and with just two regeneration points from San Francisco to DC, they can, you know, transmit the entire Library of Congress in 0.2 seconds or something like that. And he looks at me, he's like, slow down, little fella, you're not speaking my language, right? And what I realized was I also had this passion for technology. And so to be able to marry the two, I feel incredibly fortunate to be able to talk about technology, to be part of technology, to be a part of a community that, you know, as I mentioned before, you find your tribe, right? I mean, I could talk to you all day about technology and software development, just like I could talk to you all day about sharks or hockey for that matter. So I just feel very, very fortunate that my path took me that way. And so that's how I got to the developer relations space. And it's been pretty magical since then.
And was the outreach, so I remember like listservs and AIM, you know, AOL right. Instant Messenger and the groups. Yep. And for the Gen Zers who are listening to this podcast, probably have like no idea what that even is. You know, is that where you typically would find people?
Yes. Yeah, we would find people there. But more than anything, we found people in person, like the old fashioned way. So there were.
What's that?
Right. Especially the last 2 years. That's a huge question. User groups were a big part of the developer community. And there are still things like meetups and we're finding people in different ways now. But I was part of, Microsoft had an organization that they started called INETA, which was the International .NET Association. And it was an umbrella organization that was set up to support user groups around the world. And we would go and we would talk to people at user groups. I was a volunteer for the organization and talk about technology, pair up speakers with user groups. And you could get at a user group meeting, you know, some of the larger ones in the heyday would have 200 people showing up for pizza and soda and just talking about .NET or, you know, C# or VB.NET for that matter. So, you know, it was super exciting. And that was, so we relied, you still relied on technology some and listservs, like you said, and actually there, I have some friends who could still tell you what their ICQ number was because that was our chat. But yeah, I mean, it was a lot of in-person interaction, going to conferences and events and then user groups and meetups. So.
Yeah. I'm wondering, do you think that's going to come back? Because I feel like there is an itch to get out there. I mentioned Gen Z, and actually Gen Z of all the generations are probably the ones who are going to push for that in-person more than anyone.
Yeah, 100% I do. I think that there are, one of the things we found over the last 2 years, as we were trying to still engage with the community, was that there are a lot of amazing tools available right now. And we spun up a Twitch channel, and we're live streaming every day throughout the week. We have regular shows, we have long format streams, and engaging with people in chat there is awesome, but you still cannot replicate the one-on-one in-person interaction that you get at a conference. We tried to replicate the hallway tracks through AR, VR. We tried all different ways. And for some reason, when you are in a digital environment, it's really hard to, I think people feel time constrained. They don't have the energy that you get when you're in person. And so I do think that we'll see a resurgence of that. And we're already seeing, we have a number of events that we'll be participating in person in April and May. And the team is super, super excited about that.
Yeah, you mentioned VR, by the way. We did an episode on the metaverse where I the company Modern actually sent me an Oculus. I got to do it for the first time and jump into their workspace. And
yeah,
I have to say, it did feel more real than this, which is odd because I am for this is an audio podcast, but for those listening, I am looking at Sarah. We are talking. We're having a conversation. I can see you in real life, if you will. But it's still 2D.
Right.
And when you get into that virtual world, even though I'm looking at a cartoon, it felt more real and like I was actually there. So it's interesting. I feel like we have that dual thing going on, right? We have that happening, and it will.
Yep.
And then, jumping back into reality. Yeah.
We actually replicated the seventh floor of our office in Sofia, Bulgaria. And it has, that's more of our a hangout space. We have ping pong tables and all that. We replicated that in a VR world, and we were able to, we invited people in and we played ping pong. We threw chairs off the deck that we balcony, which we obviously wouldn't do in person, but it was really fun to have that interaction. I think the hardest part for us was that, you know, you talked about the Oculus, everybody has different headsets and different ways that they engage. And so until we have a more unified approach to that, it's going to be harder to have that, but it's definitely exciting. And it does, like you said, it helps having, you know, being able to see, even if you can't see their real legs, seeing people look like human is pretty awesome.
Sort of a torso. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting. I feel like what I was trying to nail down when I was in there and trying to figure it all out, what is missing still. And it's the ability to, like, so I'm a community builder and networker by trade as well.
Right.
And it's the ability to tap someone on the shoulder while they're in mid conversation, literally interrupt them and jump in, or have your own conversation. That still doesn't exist. And that is an in-person thing. I don't think we'll ever be able to, who knows? We probably will.
Well, but, and think about it too. When you're at a conference and people are having a conversation in the hallway, if you walk up to people who are talking, you can tell by their features if it's okay to jump in or if it's more of a private conversation.
Yep.
And in AR, VR world, it's really, I mean, I remember feeling so incredibly rude because I actually walked through one of my coworkers, you know,
you can actually walk through someone accidentally. That is a real thing. That's not like.
Right. And it's awful when you do it, because I'm like, oh my gosh, that was so rude. I would never walk through somebody in person, but couldn't see you can't see their expressions or their body language. So I think once that is to a point where we can replicate that, then it's going to get really real.
So. You can see hand movements. So if you really did anger them, I think you'd get a hand gesture.
Very true.
Today's episode of the Humans of DevOps podcast is sponsored by Collide. Collide is an endpoint security solution that sends your employees important and timely security recommendations for their Linux, Mac, and Windows devices right inside Slack. Collide is perfect for organizations that care deeply about compliance and security, but don't want to get there by locking down devices to the point where they become unusable. Instead of frustrating your employees, Collide educates them about security and device management while directing them to fix important problems. You can try Collide with all its features on an unlimited number of devices free for 14 days. No credit card required. Visit collide.com/HODP to sign up today. That's Collide, KOLIDE.com/HODP. Enter your email when prompted to receive your free Collide gift bundle after trial activation. So that's some of the progress is making. What other initiatives is Progress doing that you're most proud of that focus on the human side of software
development? Yeah, you know, Progress is one of the things that I'm proud of, is that we really do put people first, not just our employees, but people in general, which is amazing. You know, with all the things that are going on in Ukraine right now, Progress has committed to donating $100,000 to the World Health Organization Emergency Appeal for Ukraine. But on top of that, my team last week did a live stream where it was a charity to benefit the same organization, where we actually talked about the human side of software. We talked about gaps, knowledge gaps and how to fix them, gender gaps, all of those kinds of things. We talked about how to research new technologies, all of that. But what was really exciting to me was that the community came together and donated over $5,000 to that organization.
That's awesome. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, it was one of those days where I think there were tears on the live stream because we felt like we were really honestly doing something that hopefully will make a difference in people's lives. And again, talking about your tribe and bringing people together, this was a community endeavor, right? This wasn't, you know, we were hosting it, but the community came together and did that. And it was a pretty amazing feeling to be part of something like that. So, you know, from the human side, those kinds of things are great. We have scholarships, you know, the Progress Women in STEM series of scholarships, which is fantastic. Mary C.K. Scholarship in Women for STEM is part of that. It's a $10,000 four-year renewable scholarship for women in Massachusetts because our corporate headquarters are based there. And we just announced one in India as well. It's when we think about how Progress responds to the world and thinks about as an organization and a corporation thinks about the humans who are part of everything, it really it's exciting to me to be part of something like that.
Yeah, that sounds great. And yeah, a company that doesn't keep its head in the sand isn't afraid to get into what's going on in the world. I think that's really important, and we all have a role to play, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, I think one of the things the pandemic has shown us all is that there is a human side to everything that we do, right? I mean, I was a remote employee I joke that I was remote before remote was cool, but I was a remote employee before
Same here.
COVID hit. Yeah. And it's before COVID hit, you know, it was, I'm sure you saw, I'm sure probably all of your listeners saw the gentleman who did that interview a few years back on television, and his child comes in on a little walker and, you know, he's trying to get him out. Yeah. If you had asked my daughter what I looked like when I was on a call, it was usually, and it's going to be, you know, I'm like hand gestures, you know, I'm on the phone whispering, you know, all of those things. And what the pandemic did was open up our homes to each other, right? You saw the human side in all of us. And to me, I think that's one of the silver linings of everything we've been through, because it shows that there's so much more dimension to everybody than just what you do in your day job.
Definitely. I couldn't subscribe to that more. I think a lot of us feel that way. And certainly, I mean, the theme of this podcast, you know, the humans of DevOps, we don't talk, you know, tech here. We don't get into, you know, too technical. We talk human. We yep. talk about the issues that are going on. So yeah, I think we speak the same language.
Yeah.
We kind of touched on this a little bit, but you know, we talked about how it was. What about today? You know, how has accessibility played into the human side of development today?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, when you think about, and again, I'm gonna go back to the pandemic. There were, prior to the pandemic, we had apps that were apps of convenience, right? You know, it was convenient to order my groceries ahead of time or order a cup of coffee or even engage with my doctor. It was, you could do that on your phone, on a mobile device. When the pandemic hit, some of those things that were apps of convenience all of a sudden became apps of necessity. And one of the things that did is open up the understanding that if we don't democratize our apps, they're not going to be able to be, you know, these apps of necessity won't be usable by, you know, one in five people have a disability of some sort. And every single one of us will have a disability at some point in our lives, right? So that could just be, you know, that you broke your arm, right? It could be that you had your eyes dilated and you're wearing those big, you know, dark glasses and you can't see things very well. But what that showed us is that our reliance on technology gets, as that becomes more ubiquitous with the world we're living in, it's that much more imperative that we are thinking and developing with an accessibility mindset first. And I think for developers, it's hard because sometimes you say accessibility and there's this overwhelming sense of oh my gosh, what does that mean? You know, how do I really do that? But it's things like thinking about, pinch and zoom and making sure that we're able to do that. It's thinking about the time limits on forms that they're creating, right? And making sure that if somebody has a disability that means that they need to take more time to fill out that form, that we're not time limiting them by, that we're giving a generous amount of time. So it's all of those things that I think that, again, a silver lining of the pandemic has pushed us to really start thinking about how do we make sure that everybody can use the technology that we're creating.
Yeah, I love what you just said. And I think that goes back to even the previous question and answer is we're actually taking time and thinking about what people need and want. Right. And it's not pushed to the, for the longest time, it just would be, we don't have time to think about that stuff.
Right.
We need to think about everything. We need to make money. We need to think about everything else. And we ignore people. And people are the ones. Headcount used to be how you describe staff, even staff, it's the people who work for you, right?
Right. So, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, we believe that so much at Progress that our human resources team is actually called the people team. Like we don't think about it as human resources. It is, they are the people team. They're there to talk and help our people. And which is a pretty awesome mindset, I think.
I think so too. I think it's about time that we made that shift. We talked to someone who told me like for the longest time in their career, they weren't allowed to talk about themselves. Hmm. And I was like, wow, that's fascinating. And it's like, I feel like we're making that pivot right now. We're, each generation, each time, you constantly go through these shifts and changes. And I think this is a big one that in a few years from now, we're going to look back and say, this was a big change in the workforce.
Right. Right. 100% agree with that. Yeah.
So what are some steps that organizations can take to improve developer relations?
I think thinking about developer relations as a necessary discipline that it's hard to measure. So let me back up. One of the things when people talk about developer relations, for a long time, there was this, it was kind of in this nebulous area. Should it be part of the sales organization? Should it be part of the marketing organization? Where does it live? And when you were talking about headcount, initially people were like, if we can't justify the spend that it costs to have people on staff who are subject matter experts and traveling to conferences, and then maybe we just disband it and get rid of it. What we've had to learn on our end is how do we measure what we do, right? And how do we, so when you think about how can an organization improve their developer relations, first they have to understand why they're doing it, right? So the purpose for our team is, to be that conduit between the developers and the developer community and our product teams and our organization in a really, again, natural way, right? And being the voice for the community, even if it's not necessarily popular with what the general thinking is from an organizational perspective, and vice versa. How do we kind of have that two-way conversation? So we sat down and really thought, how do we measure this so that it's not just a collection of vanity metrics, but it shows value to the business while also showing value to the community? And so the one thing that we really thought about is that engagement, right? I don't care if we're reaching 4 million people, if really, what I really need is to have engagement with this core group of developers who are, I'm providing value to them and vice versa, right? So we look at engagement rates. We look at how many chat messages are we exchanging? We stopped using our social channels as megaphones to just yell at people, and we actually have conversations with people. So I think thinking about and truly understanding why you're doing developer relations is and what your expected value is from that is probably the first step that most DevOps organizations can take. Knowing your why, knowing your purpose.
Yeah, that's knowing your purpose. we talked about accessibility.
Right.
And to what you just said, I mean, there's also that trust factor that you got to build, right? You got to be authentic with what you're saying. And so we talked about accessibility. What about sustainability? How does that play into the human side of development?
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes back to genuinely being in any community, if you're not genuine to your beliefs, you won't be successful. A community will sniff that out. The faking it just because it's popular is not,
You know when someone's right. Not authentic.
Right. So, from a sustainability perspective, progress itself has taken a step back and looked at things like when we're sending out prizes, are we being good stewards of the environment and making sure that we are, do we have excessive packaging? Are there simple ways that we could send out prizes or awards or community gifts without hurting the environment? Take a step back and we look at that. I think that, we've done some things within our office spaces and we're looking at different ways, especially, as we return to office in some form or fashion, are there ways that we can be provide access to office space without excess, right? So, I think that from a sustainability perspective, it really goes back to truly thinking about what your beliefs are, knowing your purpose there and not just talking about it, but doing it. So, we try very hard to walk the walk as much as we are talking the talk.
Actions very much often are louder than words, right?
Absolutely. Yep. Yep.
Yep. So what does a sustainable and accessible future in tech look like?
That is a great question. So I think, an accessible future in tech means rethinking, obviously coming to the development table with an accessibility first mindset, but that also means when we're teaching and training developers from an early stage that we're also building that into the process. Because I think, as I mentioned, when you bring accessibility to the table to somebody who's been doing this for years, I think there's this overwhelming sense of, I don't know how to do that, right? And it really is, there are a lot of very basic things, and part of that's just an education thing. And that education is actually the same answer for sustainability, right? I think that educating developers on how do we build sustainable software? How are the environments that we're working in sustainable? How are we thinking about how we're engaging the community? And all of that comes back down to education, right? And so if we take a step back and I think the younger generations have an advantage at this point because I think this is something that's more part of our culture. But I think for people who are in the have been in business for a while and established in their careers, it's really just kind of taking a reset and looking at both of those things. It's not that they didn't care about them before, but there wasn't this intersection between our personal beliefs and our actual subject matter expertise, right? So I think as our world blends and work and home and personal all become one, as we look at the human as a whole and a three-dimensional existence, I think that that's where that education and training becomes really important.
For those who listen to the podcast, I often bring up my daughter and parenting because I feel like many things that we deal with in issues that we deal with in the workforce or just in life can often go back to a parenting skill.
100%.
and I think about, so my daughter's 4.5. She misses the cutoff. So she has another, year to go before kindergarten, but we're teaching them the transition, right? She's in preschool or pre-K.
Right.
And it's a very hard transition of home, school,
right?
How you act in two different environments. And
right.
It's so interesting because it's like telling someone who has no frame of reference that they can't act a certain way in one area is a very, it's like, what? Why? I don't get it. And I feel like as a society, we don't get it either. It's like we're trying to basically unlearn some of that too. I think it's good that we're going through this because it does seem silly that, of course, you can't like scream out in the middle of a lesson at school and you're not going to go around work telling the most personal thing about you that might be incriminating or weird or I don't know. Like there's just things you don't say.
Right.
But there are things that we can share and we should
100%.
Be human.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Because at the end of the day, we are all human. Right. And when you start, can look at, I think this is probably and hopefully the next step in the evolution in the changes that are happening in society. I think when we can stop and understand that everybody is human, right, and see their vulnerabilities and see who they are, we also can start to understand intent, right? So by understanding intent, you aren't necessarily going to be offended by something that somebody said over here because you understand where they're coming from, right? And so, but I also agree with you as a parent. Yes, there are things, you know, I mentioned to you, I think hockey, I love watching hockey. My daughter is a nice hockey player. We actually leave next week for the Philadelphia area. She's playing in the USA Hockey National Tournament.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And yeah, thank you.
Well, good luck to her.
Thank you. We're super excited about that. But you know, as an athlete, and even growing up, she's been playing hockey since she was four. She has been around hockey. She heard some things in the locker room, you know, with the older kids, and now she is an older kid, but we've always said there's a time and a place for things, right? Yes. You know, and so you do still have to have boundaries. There's no question about that. Yes. But to think that any of us is just what we do at work or just what we do at home is very silly. And I think, again, the pandemic has opened up. You and I are sitting here and I'm seeing, you know, the inside of your office. You're seeing mine. Usually I would have, it's spring break here, so I had to let everybody know you and I are talking, so please don't come in the office. But, you know, there are, usually there's a dog who walks in or my daughter who checks in or something along those lines. So, you know, I think that we do have to find that balance.
Definitely. And I think that we are, and I think we're all trying to figure it out together. Yep. And it goes back to what we were saying before. This is a very unique time, and I hope it changes a lot of things.
And I think it requires grace, right? It requires us not to just give each other grace, but to expect, you know, to give and get grace, right? You know, when we are, the beauty of humans is that we are all flawed as well, right? And so understanding that, and that goes back to, I think, my comment about intent. As flawed humans, not everybody is set out to do or say something that might offend you, you know, and so being able to take a step back and say, okay, we are all, nobody's perfect. How do we move forward and talk as humans?
Absolutely. It's seeing the lens from someone else's viewpoint, you know, seeing it through someone else's lens, empathic leadership, being an empathetic person. Empathy is so important. We talked about it on this podcast actually right before we left for the holidays and the new year. And I thought that was a great way to end the year and set out this year myself, you know, making the effort of leading with empathy. And I think for all of us, figuring out how, you know, we can be empathetic people is very important.
Absolutely.
So that now we'll transition to sharks. Just like that. I don't believe in transitions. So let's go back to that bio and you're swimming with sharks. So is this like legit swimming with, so I've done the, like you dive down and there's the steel cage or whatever, you know, wall separating you. Is this
real, like diving underwater with sharks. So my husband and I have been divers for a long time, and actually our daughter is a diver. Her 10th birthday she got certified to dive, and it's funny, when I go out on a boat and I see a shark on the surface, I don't think, oh, you know what, I should jump in with that. But we seek out dive trips where we can actually go diving with sharks. We did an amazing trip to Cocos Island, where it was during an off year for sharks in Cocos Island. But on one dive, we saw five different species of sharks. And we're sitting in this, or we were underwater and kind of on this rock ledge, and we have a tiger shark swims through, which was
a big shark.
It was a massive shark, and it was one of those ones where you just, he let you know that he commanded respect. You know, he just, so, but we saw,
I'd say,
hammerheads, black tip, white tip Galapagos sharks, I believe the Galapagos shark, and then the tiger shark, which was just an incredible experience. One of those things that I will never forget. We did a trip to Galapagos where we had hundreds of schooling hammerheads below us, and then when we were out on, I think we were at either Wolf or Darwin Island, you would go and just, again, hold on to the rocks as the hammerheads swim by. And this goes back to my wouldn't jump in with them, but I I do crazy things when so I'm underwater, and you're not supposed to hold your breath underwater, right, when you're diving, if you're moving within the water column. But I was sitting there, and this hammerhead is swimming towards me, and I thought, and they're very skittish, right? So they're very scared by your bubbles. So I thought, I wonder if I don't exhale my bubbles, how close will this hammerhead get to me? Which is not like a normal thought that most people have, but I did. And my husband got an amazing picture of the hammerhead. It was beautiful, but it came probably 2 feet in front of me before I thought, what am I doing? And I exhaled my bubbles and, swam away. But,
I'm like freaking out as you're telling me this. Like, I could feel my heart racing. That is wow. Well, good for you.
So, I don't think I could do that. No, you know what? They're so graceful underwater. And going back to intent, we were talking, I mean, sharks have such a bad rap. And there are some that are definitely the tiger shark I did not want to mess with. And we had one dive in the Bahamas where it was a dusk dive, which is great because you can they feed. So everything's feeding at that point. So you see a lot of life.
You jumped into the water with sharks that were like,
well, hungry. Yeah, I mean, everything is feeding, but yeah, there was a bull shark who was swimming. He was started to circle as we were finishing our safety stop. And we thought, you know what? I think it's probably time to get out. Like, this is not one we want to mess with. But we've been on some incredible, like I said, I could talk about this forever. Diving with sharks is just, incredible.
So. Yeah, that does sound incredible. Also, I think I am like panicked just hearing you say it. I went on my honeymoon was in Fiji, and every day at the resort you get a little notice, and we went snorkeling because they finally convinced us to go, and we went, and it's beautiful. I mean, the full reef's untouched. And then we get home, and in the newsletter it said, swim with friendly reef sharks. So we think, okay, they're friendly here. What do we know? And we get home, and it's Shark Week, and they're like the actual world's most dangerous shark, I guess, with the most human attacks, whatever, is the Fijian reef shark. And we're like, okay, great. Better we didn't know that before.
Right, exactly.
On that exactly. Snorkel. We're coming up at the end of the podcast, and I like to ask one thought-provoking, usually personal question. So today's question for you is, what's something that everyone in your industry should stop or start doing?
I think I've said it probably a couple times here, but I definitely would say from the developer perspective, I would pause and approach all of your applications with an accessibility first mindset. I would broaden your scope and understanding of your audience. So a lot of times when people think about, who am I creating this application for? They think about, personas and demographics and all of that, but really understand that humans are the ones who are using our software, and understand that humans do have impairments or limitations that we need to be developing for so that we can democratize applications across the board.
Awesome. Sarah, thank you so much for joining me on today's episode. I had a lot of fun talking to you about the topics, and I feel like we could talk all day about DevRel, but also sharks. So thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the Humans of DevOps podcast. I'm going to end this episode the same way I always do, encouraging you to become a member of DevOps Institute to get access to even more great resources just like this one. Until next time, stay safe, stay healthy, and most of all, stay human. Live long and prosper.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Humans of DevOps podcast. Don't forget to join our global community to get access to even more great resources like this. Until next time, remember, you are part of something bigger than yourself. You belong.